All right, good morning, everyone. We will go on the record and come to order. The Commission is hereby convened in open session on Wednesday, May 9, 2018, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor v. the American Coal Company, docket number Lake 2011-13. Present are myself, Acting Chairman Althan, Commissioner Jordan, Commissioner Young, and Commissioner Cohen. By the terms of the Commission order setting oral argument, each side is allocated 30 minutes for the presentation of its argument. The Secretary of Labor and the American Coal Company are proceeding first and splitting their time equally, with the Secretary's counsel presenting first. The United Mine Workers of America and the United Steel, Paper and Forestry, Rubber Manufacturing, Energy, Allied Industrial and Service Workers Union will then present their argument. The Secretary has reserved 2 of his minutes for rebuttal, and I understand American Coal Company is also reserving 2 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel, would you please introduce yourselves for the record?
For the Secretary of Labor, Ed Waldman.
For the American Coal Company, Jason Harden.
For the United Mine Workers and United Steel Workers, Arthur Traynor.
Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Waldman.
May it please the Commission, when this case was previously before the Commission and the Commission held its subsequent open meeting, Commissioner Althan made a comment to the effect that everybody concerned here should proceed with confidence and humility. We're 2 years down the road now. I don't think we've quite hit the right balance there between those two characteristics, but the unique procedural posture of this case offers us an opportunity, I think, to step back for just a moment and remind ourselves of some important first principles. Congress assigned to the Secretary and the Commission very different and distinct roles under the Mine Act. And nevertheless, the Secretary and the Commission share a common goal, and that is, of course, to protect the safety and health of the nation's miners. That goal is shared as well by operators and by miners, and we're fortunate to have very able representatives of both the operator and the miners participating today. The Secretary's and the Commission's roles under the Mine Act naturally will bring them into conflict in certain cases, as it has in this case. It's important, however, that no matter what disagreements arise between the Secretary and the Commission, that the Secretary and his attorneys and the Commission and its administrative law judges always strive to engage each other mutually with professionalism and respect. The Secretary respects the Commission's previous decision in this case. The Secretary is not here today to re-argue that decision. The Secretary is here today because on remand, the ALJ applied an incorrect standard in reviewing the proposed settlement.
When you say respects the Commission's decision, you're not foreclosing appealing at some future
just,
time.
I'm not foreclosing it, and I'm not guaranteeing it. It's just
you're just saying that for purposes of this case and its present posture,
we're accepting the Commission's decision as the law of the case.
Which you have to do because it's the law of the case,
that's
right?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
On behalf of the Secretary today, I'd like to make just one point, and that is to emphasize the new information that the Secretary provided to the administrative law judge on remand in support of the proposed settlement. The proposed settlement didn't change. It's still the same proposed settlement as it was the first time around. But respecting the Commission's holding in its previous decision that the Secretary had failed to provide any facts in support of the proposed settlement, Secretary came back to the ALJ and provided some new information. The new information that the Secretary provided to the ALJ on remand was this, that the Secretary's assessment of the 32 citations involved in the case indicated that 14 of those 32 were vulnerable on issues of negligence and gravity. An additional one was vulnerable on the applicability of the cited standard. So 15 out of the 32 the Secretary believed were potentially vulnerable. And if the Secretary were to lose on each of those points, applying the Secretary's Part 100 penalty tables, which of course we recognize the ALJ wouldn't be bound to apply. But using that as a guideline, we believe that we were vulnerable to approximately a 50% reduction in the penalties at trial.
This analysis that you've described in your motion, would I assume correctly that that was performed after the Commission's August 2016 decision?
No. That analysis was performed prior to and during the settlement negotiations and prior to the settlement agreement. It was disclosed for the first time to the ALJ on remand.
But it said, you said in the motion that the analysis was performed by an attorney. It had been my understanding, and this could have been wrong, that the initial settlement was handled by a CLR.
The initial settlement was handled by a CLR, and then after the ALJ rejected it, it was handed over to a regional attorney who then provided an additional settlement motion to the ALJ at that time, which was also rejected. So, in addition to the 14 out of 32 and the 1 out of 32 and minus 50%, the Secretary also provided some further explanation to the ALJ in terms of the fact that American Coal was agreeing to accept all 32 citations as written, and that agreement had significant non-monetary value to the Secretary for future enforcement purposes. And the Secretary also provided some explanation that although the savings of litigation and collection costs was not a factor in deciding to settle the case, the opportunity costs that the Secretary would forego by having to try this case as opposed to using the Secretary's limited enforcement resources in some other potentially higher priority case was a factor in deciding to settle the case as well. So the ALJ then didn't take any of these, any of this new information to qualify as facts under the Commission's Rule 31. And that's where we think the ALJ erred. The ALJ defined the term facts under Rule 31 very narrowly to mean only facts related to the Section 110I penalty criteria or to the individual citations themselves.
Mr. Wallman, do you think by facts the judge meant facts that were agreed to, sort of conceded facts, or just the factual assertions on each side?
I think that the ALJ made it pretty clear that he wanted factual assertions, but he also made it pretty clear that he wanted the Secretary to at least admit that the factual assertions made by American Coal presented legitimate issues of fact that can only be resolved at trial.
That's sort of getting to my point. Knowing the predilections of the particular judge with whom you were dealing, would it have overburdened the attorney for the 15 violations that formed the reason for settling, to have just put in a sentence for each one along the lines of citation so-and-so charges a violation of XYZ is assessed at $2,200. The operator contends that the violation did not occur, but if it did, and then what they asserted, for example, on an accumulation, the operator asserts there was only 2 inches of coal for 5 feet, which is not a significant... Would that have been hard to do and satisfy this judge?
Maybe not, but I think the question is what's practical versus what's legally required. Perhaps the Secretary didn't view this in the most practical way.
I mean, this whole controversy strikes me as like, with all apologies, the Secretary and Judge Moran, like children in a schoolyard fighting over who's entitled to the loaf of bread. I mean, it could have been worked out. I'm hard for me to understand why this didn't get settled. So if the Secretary had just come forward with 15 factual statements about the operator's position, we might not have to be sitting here today.
We probably shouldn't be sitting here today anyway, Commissioner Olson, because I believe the facts that the Secretary did provide and the facts that American Coal provided to the ALJ were more than sufficient to satisfy the legal standard of what's required. And I understand that, you know, with individual judges, you might make practical
sometimes
adjustments.
Sometimes you have to jump a little higher to get it.
Yeah, no, I hear you, and that's a point well taken. But the issue here really is what the legal requirement is. And, you know, if we're going to have to, with respect to certain judges, if we're going to have to make those additional submissions, you know, we could end up with certain judges having backups of settlements piled on that judge's desk. And, you know, that doesn't really serve the purpose of the act when it's really just an individual judge's predilection as opposed to a legal requirement.
So you're saying you're afraid other judges will catch the Judge Moran disease?
It's not only this one judge who has presented a problem with respect to settlements. We've had problems with other judges as well, and that's why we think it's important that the commission establish a legal requirement. And in fact, the commission has established a legal requirement, and it's interesting that in the ALJ's decision on remand, in fact, his multiple decisions on remand, he never once cited the commission's legal standard, which is fair, reasonable, appropriate under the facts, and in the public interest. Not once.
Well, but perhaps he did that because he hadn't received sufficient facts to be able to get to that point.
Well, that certainly is what the ALJ said. Yeah. But that's where we think that the ALJ made a legal error, because we believe that the facts that the Secretary provided to him were facts that would have enabled him to address those criteria.
Counsel.
Go ahead.
But shouldn't a judge has to be able to make that determination of if it's fair or reasonable in the public interest. And you said, well, we submitted facts sufficient that he should have been able to make that determination. And you submitted a conclusion about your review of the citations, and I'm trying to determine. I mean, each judge is going to have to be allowed to make. There's going to be some variation.
Of course.
Don't see a rigid standard coming out, because the standard itself is general, and we're still going to have to review what's reasonable of what the judge did.
Of course,
but. Is it unreasonable for the judge to reject a conclusory statement like, we have reviewed these citations, we find 15 to be vulnerable, that we are vulnerable on 15, and if we lose those entirely, we would be only able to collect 50%, the penalty. He wants a little more fleshed out. Now, maybe he went, and the other issue before us is, did he go too far, demanding a sort of recitation of each criteria under 110, but isn't it maybe a little sparse, to say just, well, we've reviewed it, and as my colleague questioned, we wouldn't even know who reviewed it, a CLR, an attorney. How reasonable was that conclusion that we're vulnerable? Isn't the judge just asking for more support to back up that?
Yes, the judge is. And the question here, though, is whether what the Secretary provided to the judge constituted facts or not. And that's what we're asking the Commission to decide and to hold, that what the Secretary provided were facts that the ALJ should have considered. The ALJ refused to consider what was submitted to him under the Commission's legal standard, because he said the Secretary continues to refuse to provide facts in support of the settlement.
Wait, what are the facts? I'm sorry. Well, I won't want to take up the time. Are you referring to the offer to submit facts by the operator?
No, what I'm referring to is this. When the case was, and I'm over my time here,
I'm sorry.
I apologize. May I proceed?
Yeah, yes. You finish the answer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when the case was previously before the commission criticized the secretary for essentially using the mantra risk litigation. So on remand, what we did was we specifically quantified that risk litigation, and we said, you know, we think these 14 are vulnerable on this basis, this one is vulnerable on this basis, and the overall penalties are vulnerable to a 50% reduction. So
but
we're not.
You didn't say this one is vulnerable. You said 14
that's
are
right.
vulnerable.
That's right, and that was very deliberate.
And you could have, and it was very deliberate not to say
that's
the specific
right.
ones.
That's
because
right.
you wanted to be able to get away with summarizing.
No, right? Not because we wanted to be able to get away with anything, because we didn't want to tip our hand as to the strengths and weaknesses of our case to the same ALJ who might be trying this case on the merits if he continues to reject the settlement. And we didn't want to tip our hand to our adversaries.
But you tip your hand. I mean, the commission, we have figures. We asked our office of judges to provide figures on the number of cases that had been, settlements had been approved.
Mm-hmm.
From fiscal year 2015 through the first 7 or 8 months of fiscal year 2018, the figures that came back were that something like 99.83% of settlements had been approved. Do you disagree with that range?
No, I don't.
Okay. So in those cases, aren't you tipping your hand in the same way you're saying that you didn't want to tip your hand here?
No, I don't see how you get from point A to point B there, because we don't know what the content of those settlements, 99.83%.
I've seen a lot of settlements that have been approved. They're fact-specific.
In some cases, the secretary can be fact-specific. In other cases, for strategic reasons, the secretary prefers not to be fact-specific. This is one of those cases.
Well,
just because the secretary provides certain information in one case, that doesn't mean the secretary is bound to provide that identical information in every case.
Assuming that our judges require facts specific to the cases in approving settlements, it would appear that you do provide facts specific to the settlements in over 99% of your settlement motions. You didn't do it here.
I'm not comfortable agreeing with that characterization of the 99%, because I don't know really what the contents of those 99% are. But I will say that in this case, we did provide case-specific facts. We did not provide citation-specific facts. And I don't think that the commission's case law requires that. It never has before. I don't read the commission's case law, previous case law, as ever having required citation-specific facts to be provided to justify settlement. And the commission chose to use the word facts in Rule 31, which is a rather broad term, to now construe that to mean facts specific to individual citations would be a very, very restrictive interpretation there. And I'd like to also mention, if I may continue to go
yes,
over my
please.
Time,
with
respect to the 99.83, you know, I'd like to point out that, you know, that statistic is true, but statistics can be misleading as well. The actual rejections of settlements are very, very few and far between, but they only represent the tip of the iceberg with respect to this problem, because what we have is a number of administrative law judges who are making phone calls, sending emails, deputizing their clerks to do the same thing, to ask the sides for more information. Please give us this exhibit. Please give us this photograph. Please give us such and such, in order for us to evaluate the settlement. And sometimes we feel that we can comply with that, and sometimes we feel that we can't. But I think that maybe the you know, the commission may not be aware of how widespread that practice is because it's not something that's recorded in a published decision.
What's wrong with that practice?
What's wrong with that practice is that sometimes it's asking the secretary to either provide inspector's notes or some type of document that might be used for evidence in the case, or it's asking the secretary to concede that the respondent's argument has merit, or it's asking the secretary to concede that his description of the practice or condition that was a violation was incorrect. You know, these are things that you know, a litigator doesn't want to do at the settlement stage.
But apparently you do it.
We do it when we, I think, you know, every case is different. And, you know, sometimes you have one or two citations in a case. Other times, like this, you have 32. And the issues are always different. So how attorneys approach a case in terms of agreeing to settle it can vary tremendously depending upon the number of citations, what the citations are for, the underlying facts, the underlying strengths and weaknesses. Sometimes attorneys might, you know, base a settlement on their mental impressions of the strength or weakness of their own opposing attorney or the particular judge that they have. You know, and these are things that attorneys, and I believe all of the sitting commissioners today were trial attorneys at some point, you all know what negotiating a settlement is about, and you know that, you know, as a practical matter, there are things that you do not want to reveal to your opponent, you do not want to reveal to the judge when you're trying to settle a case.
You know, I have in front of me the decision by Judge Moran approving the settlement of the five cases in this docket which had been specially assessed. There were separate settlements of each of those five cases, right? You agree with me on that? And they were all settled with substantial reductions, which Judge Moran approved, correct?
Okay.
And his reasoning is, for example, just to take the first one, this violation was issued because a loose rib was observed on the 13th West Headgate unit. This citation was specially assessed because it cited a violation of 30 CFR 202A, which is a rule to live by. Rule to live by standards are the standards that have and continue to contribute to serious accidents and fatalities. Although respondent has a history of 202A violations, the inspector determined that the violation resulted from respondent's moderate degree of negligence, and it is not known how long the condition existed or who was aware of the violative condition. As such, the parties have negotiated a penalty more than the regular assessment. And it then says that the parties have agreed to the appropriateness of the settlement, and it reduces a $7,700 special assessed penalty to $3,000. Judge Moran has accepted a lot of information there without going into anything like the fears that you're describing of thought, you know, anything like that. I mean, it does not seem unreasonable to provide information sufficient to satisfy even Judge Moran when he will approve a settlement on this basis.
Well, okay.
Is that wrong?
It's not wrong as a matter of practicality, but again, the question is what the legal requirement is. As a practical matter, if the secretary wants to spend enough time, you know, to write all that out, and American Coal wants to spend enough time to write all that out.
Well, American Coal has offered to do it.
Yeah.
So there, it doesn't bother them.
I don't know. You can ask Mr. Hardin when he comes up here if he really meant that he was going to, you know, write out specific fact-based reasons for all 32 citations. But when you're talking about 5 versus 32, it's very different. And when you're talking about more than 32, it could be even more different. I mean, it's not uncommon for settlements to include 20, 30, 40, 50 citations at a time. And when you're getting into numbers like that, it does get to be rather impractical to indulge in ALJ's particular preferences as opposed to what's legally required. And again, the question about what's legally required, how do you define a fact under Rule 31? And the ALJ was saying that the only thing that qualifies as fact under Rule 31 is something related to the Section 110I penalty criteria or to the individual citations themselves. And the Secretary simply disagrees with that and would ask the Commission to hold that the definition of facts in Rule 31 is broader than that and can include the types of settlement facts that the Secretary provided to the ALJ on remand in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Waldman. We better allow Mr. Harden to get up before he forgets what he wanted to say.
Thank you.
Oh, 1 second, please, sir. All right, good morning, Mr. Harden.
May it please the Commission. First, I'd just like to say thank you for letting the mine operator and myself come here and talk about these important issues. And I would stress that I think they are important. And they're important because, as the Commission has recognized several times in the prior appeal and even today, the vast majority of the contest proceedings are settled. And so how a settlement is approved is very important. And that's why I think these issues aren't just repetitive of what happened before on the prior appeal. They're new, and they again touch on what are the appropriate boundaries of the settlement approval process. First, I do want to be clear that the mine operator believes it has a settlement, and the settlement should be approved in this case. And the mine operator does stand ready, if the commission directs it to and the judge allows it to provide those facts. The mine operator doesn't believe that it should have to provide those facts, but again, the mine operator is willing to do so and frankly was not given the chance to do so on remand. And I do think that is one of the errors. You know, the mine operator offered to provide facts. The judge didn't want the mine operator to provide the facts. The judge wanted the secretary to provide the facts, and the judge wanted the secretary to admit that the facts provided presented legitimate questions of fact, which I think oversteps the boundary of what should be required in the settlement approval process. So, you know, generally, I don't want to, like Mr. Waldman, I'm not here to re-argue what the standard was set in the prior appeal, but I do want to mention at the outset why I personally think that we're here. And I think that we're here because of the Black Beauty decision. Much was made in the prior appeal about how there had been 30 years of settlements that have been approved and had never been an issue before. Well, I think that's correct, and I think that all changed with the Black Beauty decision. And what changed in the Black Beauty decision wasn't just the commission's description of the settlement approval process and the boundaries of that. That was one thing, and I think that was fairly consistent with prior commission precedent. But what was different in the Black Beauty decision was deterrence became a separate factor apart from the penalty criteria to be considered by judges in the settlement approval process or in the assessment process. And what that does, at least in my opinion, what that did was, if an ALJ wanted to, the ALJ could take Black Beauty and feel empowered to use the adjudicatory position of that judge to effectively negotiate for what that particular judge believed was a proper deterrent effect. And I think that's what's happened in this case. The judge, you know, he has been just asking for facts, but if you read the opinions, what's underlying the tenor of all of the opinions is, how could you be given a 30% reduction on these cases? It should be less. Until you tell me more. You need to tell me the facts. But, you know, when the judge looks at the petition and looks at the violations, apparently he already believes the mine operator is guilty, and we're starting from that presumption, and then we're working back from that. And I suggest that in American law, in American society, that, you know, this is, when someone is charged with a civil penalty or a criminal conduct, that they should be innocent until proven guilty. And I think that's generally how the commission has approached cases, and the secretary bears the burden of proving the violation, the statutory criteria. But what's happened after Black Beauty is judges, if they want to, can be empowered to then look at a case and go, I don't think that's good enough, and I'm going to reject this, or I'm going to require more facts until you can convince me that what you're proposing is good enough.
Well, maybe go ahead.
No, but our statistics wouldn't bear out your premise, would it? I mean, that they continue to accept settlements at 99% rate, and is there any evidence, is there nothing in the record saying that judges somehow demanded more money or other terms? Mr. Waldman says they sometimes ask for more information, but what supports your theory here?
Well, so I think there is, the statistics I don't believe capture what's been going on.
All right, what do you think's been going on?
And I know what's been going on.
All right, tell us what's been going on.
And it doesn't go on all the time, but what is going on is exactly what Mr. Waldman says, and it's not just with one judge, it's with multiple judges, where the clerks, usually first, will email or phone call, and they will have a motion for settlement in front of them, and they will want more information. And this is when facts have already been provided. Facts have been provided, okay? So it's essentially what you're discussing about. A motion is presented, and facts are in there. But the judge doesn't think the facts are enough. And so the judge doesn't call or email. The clerk does and says, hey, we have these issues with the facts you presented. We don't think they justify the reduction. Okay, so right there is the first red alert as far as the mine operator is concerned, because you know what that means? That means the judge, on an incomplete record, is substituting his or her judgment for the party's negotiations and agreement in the case already. They're already thinking, you know, the facts don't justify this, so I need more facts. And so they come out. And ultimately, in the ones that I've been involved in, because I'm, again, when the mine operator sells a case, they want the settlement approved. So what I try to encourage in that type of situation is, here are more facts. And some judges are receptive when the mine operator submits facts, and others aren't. So typically what I try to do is share the facts with the secretary's counsel, who then we talk about it, and more information is presented to the judge, who then approves it.
Why aren't we seeing that case rather than this one? I mean, if that's going on, and you say that the judge is overreaching, that the judge has already come to a view of it, the case, right?
Correct.
Why don't you refuse at that point to provide the information, and then the judge may reject the settlement, and then that case comes up here? And then we can look at the specific thing that you're claiming goes on, rather than deal with it in a case where no substantive, and I understand your distinction between substantive and procedural facts. In this case, no substantive facts have been provided to us, or to Judge Moran.
Commissioner
Cole, litigate the ones that you know, show the problem, not...
Well, let me explain why.
Yeah.
And here's the reason why. Again, the mine operator, when it sells a case, wants to get the case and the settlement approved, and the case is over. And so we do whatever we can to get the case resolved. And so that's why, I mean, the mine operator doesn't want, if a judge rejects a settlement, to say, oh, we're appealing that. We don't really care. We want the case settled. And so at that point, I, as counsel for the mine operator, does everything I can to get the case settled and resolved, which, frankly, always happens. I wasn't involved in this particular case from the outset in the first appeal. You know, and I'm not sure I would have made a difference. This may have been the test case that the secretary wanted to bring up, and they would not have been willing to provide that information.
Mr. Harden, does it always happen the settlement occurs because the operator always has to give a little more money, or
no? But there
has that ever happened?
I have had times where.
Have you ever had to go back in and throw in more money after the judge's clerk?
No.
I mean, this is off the record. There's no record here. I understand.
I agree. I've settled a lot of cases, thousands I've helped settle for violations before the commission and the judges, and I just can't remember. I do recall there have been times where a judge or the clerk expressed, this doesn't look justifiable. And at that point, so basically saying the amount wasn't good enough, and this happened on numerous occasions where we then supply information to try to convince the judge that it is proper. And is that part of the process? I mean, maybe. I mean, I guess that is. But what does happen if the judge someday says, you know what, I'm rejecting those facts that you've done? And at that point,
but that's not this day.
No, it's not this day, but do the boundaries and the standard that the commission has set up and is creating going to allow that? And I submit that they do. I'm submitting that Black Beauty with the deterrence element gives the judge the ability to effectively negotiate.
But how can we resolve that if you don't bring us that case?
Well, I can tell you a case. I mean, it's interesting, and this is a Judge Moran case I was involved in, and it's a reported decision from June 23rd, 2017, WEVA 2015, 763 and 953. And his decision in that case actually describes what happened. It actually describes exactly what I've told you here. It talks about how the parties submitted a motion for settlement approval. The judge's clerk reached out, wanted more information. The secretary provided additional information. The judge came back and asked for additional information. More information was then provided, and then 6 months later, the judge approved the settlement. So it does lay out, that decision from June 23rd, 2017 lays out exactly what I'm describing here, the process.
But we can't determine whether the judge overreached unless that's the case before us.
Well, but then that brings me to the points that American Coal raised in this appeal. And number one, the judge here, there were what I'll call procedural facts, but really, I don't know if you really want to call it procedural facts, but there were facts that weren't substantively related to the 110i criteria that were presented to the judge that the judge just rejected out of hand, didn't even consider. Just was like, this is just blather, and it's meaningless. And I submit that those facts are meaningful. I've had the luxury of also not just doing mine safety, which is by far the majority of my practice, but I've also done class action defense and class action prosecution. And I believe in this case, on the prior appeal, you discussed about, you know, fair, adequate, reasonable, appropriate under the facts, that's kind of a standard that's used for judges to determine the fairness of a class action settlement. And I can tell you, I have done it. The focus on that inquiry, frankly, is on the negotiating process and the risk assessment of experienced counsel. It's not on are the facts in one party's favors or another. And in fact, to the extent that the ones that I've been involved in, to the extent that we've done a settlement and have gotten it approved, the judges are actually interested in counsel's analysis of the facts. What does counsel think of the facts? And they look at both sides. What does the defense think of the facts? And what does the plaintiff think of the facts? And the reason they do that is because I think the judges recognize they're not going to force a party in a settlement motion, which may be denied when objectors come in, they're not going to force a party to take a position that could be later used in an admission against them. And I would submit that most parties are going to be really reluctant to characterize the facts in a fairness hearing or a motion for settlement in a class action setting. That just doesn't happen. Instead, what I can remember having done is we lay out in detail what happened in negotiations. How many back and forths have we had? You know, where did we start at? Where do we end up? What are the experience of counsel? I mean, you know, and that's one thing for the judge to consider. A CLR was involved here, not experienced counsel.
Class action might be a model, but not in the way you intend, and maybe not a good model. I mean, I think the one thing that many people in the public, including myself, you know, feel some discouragement and a sense of jaded depression about is that when you get these class action cases, it seems like the defense is like, yeah, whatever we have to do to get rid of it, whatever we have to do, we'll pay. The plaintiff's lawyers line up, they get paid, and the public, the people don't get anything. I've gotten a check once in a class action for 39 cents. It literally costs more to send the check to me than the check was worth.
That's absolutely right.
I was in a class action that was settled where the remedy that we got was not even as good as what you could get from the company in terms of a discount by just listening to some radio program. And so if you have a class action settlement, it's like, what's the public interest? For me, it's like, well, it ought to be the people getting paid. It ought to not be the lawyers getting their days made easier and better. And that's the concern. And I'm not saying that this is the case here because I'm not saying that. But the concern that our judges have is a legitimate concern, that we take these things seriously. And I think that it needs to be sufficient facts whether they're procedural facts or facts that arise in terms of the individual citations, to allow the judge to make that decision. Isn't that a fair way to look at it?
You know, Commissioner Young, I don't disagree with you on the point that generally the perception of class action settlements is bad. But I will tell you, having been on the front lines of class actions, that characterization, the broad brush, is often not really justified. And frankly, if you actually look into it, you know, it's negotiations. Does that mean you're trying to sell things for a million people? So maybe you only get 39 cents on the dollar. But I do think the judge's role, and this is where I think the circuit courts are clear, and where I think that it does provide at least kind of a
background. Although the lawyers always make out very well.
Well, not always, but I would say is one of the things that the circuit courts agree upon is that the judge who approves the settlement is not supposed to substitute his or her own judgment for the judgment of seasoned counsel who have negotiated at arm's length. In fact, usually if it's experienced counsel, an arm's length negotiation, there's usually a presumption of fairness and adequacy, and that must be overcome by objectors. And
we have a different statutory standard.
We absolutely do, and I agree with you, Commissioner Young. However, I will say, and this is one point that I'm sure you've picked up on in the briefing, which I don't think was focused upon in the past appeal. I see my time is out.
Matt, finish answering, sure.
Sorry, I've been going anyway. The commission previously looked at the legislative history to help kind of define what the boundaries are of the settlement approval process. And I submit that the legislative history actually supports our position, which is it says the process, and it uses the words the process shall take place in the public. And in the public's view. And that's exactly the point. The public needs to know that there are arm's length negotiations, that we're not always sitting at the same table, that we're fighting back and forth. We're negotiating over what we perceive to be the facts and the law and what the secretary believes the facts and the law are. And if that process is working, and if the process is in the public, and the facts of that process are known, that should at least be considered in the settlement approval analysis. I mean, it should be considered, and the judge here just rejected those facts. And I submit that the legislative history specifically suggests that those facts are appropriately considered.
Counsel, I just have a question. I think the process is something valid to be considered, but... In the class action examples that, you know, analysis framework that you've suggested, I'm wondering, in light of the fact that, you know, the plaintiffs, there might be a million plaintiffs that are sharing the remedy, as my colleague pointed out, getting 39 cents, but the defendant had to pay a million people. So might the deterrent factor have entered into also that overall framework, even in a class action settlement, because you have the process and you're looking at perhaps the defendant, that amount might be significant that they pay, and perhaps that. So our question, I understand what you're saying about the judges maybe going a little bit too overboard with substituting their view, but that's, in the end, you know, they're required to review the settlement to determine whether it's in the public interest. And that's a question, you know, whether people will be deterred from violations and the safety of the mines improved. So I don't think we can ignore that deterrent factor.
Commissioner Jordan, that's a fair point. And absolutely, looking at a class action from that perspective, you know, the amount that a defendant pays absolutely is a potential deterrent. I'm sure the judges do look at that. But what I would suggest here is in relation to this, is one element of the boundary that I don't think the commission discussed in Black Beauty. And I believe that the commission and the judge's settlement approval authority begins with the function of the commission and the ALJs. And that boundary is that the commission and the judges adjudicate disputes. They don't negotiate by statute. They're not supposed to enforce by statute, and they're not supposed to prosecute by statute. The commission and the judges adjudicate. And the approval function should be an adjudicating function, which is someone brings it to you and you do it. And I think you can't forget that at the stage of settlement, you know, we kind of have a process where it begins with a violation, which is a charging document, which and then a petition and a penalty. And those are supposed to be based on 110I criteria, the proposals of the secretary. And then it ends with, if it needs to, through a contest proceeding, a judge assessing a penalty based on the 110I criteria. A settlement is somewhere in the middle. It's not on a complete record. It's not on complete facts. And it starts with the secretary's charging document. But I submit that the charging documents are often wrong. I mean, I'm not saying it's intentional. I mean, things happen. Inspectors don't know what's been going on for 3 weeks at a mine before they come in and cite something. And maybe there's some explanation that makes sense for the gravity or negligence. And so, you know, that's where the settlement process takes place. And I just submit that the judges shouldn't be allowed to step into the shoes at the settlement process and be like, the record doesn't support this. Well, that's because a settlement's not done with a full and complete record. It's done when there's risk and there's jockeying and people are taking positions.
So, Commissioner Cohen has one last question.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on something you said before. This may be the test case the secretary wants. I think those were your words.
Yes, Commissioner.
Yeah. See, I'm concerned about that. Because with 99%, over 99% of the cases settled, and understanding that back in 2014, the solicitor's office put out a document saying, this will be our test case, and that their position then was the commission should not look at anything other than the fact that we've agreed to it. It should be purely discretionary on the part of the secretary. And they litigated that the first time around. They had that on appeal. When they lost after our first decision, they took that to the circuit court on appeal and then withdrew the appeal and perhaps thought, well, we don't want to litigate that now in that term. Let's go back and give them a little bit more. And then we'll take them both up. Why is that an incorrect scenario?
Commissioner Cohen, I'm aware of the document you're talking about by the test case, and I'm aware of what happened. I can tell you this. From the mine operator's perspective, we don't really care if it's a test case or not. We want our settlement approved.
Well, I understand that.
And
I put the question to you. Because you said
maybe
a test case.
Right, but it is a test case. But again, I think that's a test case is fine. Because at the end of the day, what the mine operator wants and what the mining industry wants is what are the rules of the playing field here, and who should we be negotiating with? Do we negotiate with the secretary, or do we have to negotiate with the secretary first and then a judge second? We just want to know who to negotiate with.
Why can't you negotiate with the secretary and then make sure that some substantive facts are presented in the settlement motion to the judge?
And that's exactly what I've tried to do in my career in front of the administrative law judges of the commission.
And it looks like you were willing to do that here. And
we're still willing to do it.
I mean, I think
I would say that a boundary, by the way, this is a great point, I want to make sure the commission is clear, is that I do believe an error of the judge was the judge should have allowed the mine operator to submit facts. I don't believe the commission procedural rules say the secretary has to submit facts. It says the parties, and mine operators are a party. And if we have what we believe to be facts that satisfy the judgment, we should be allowed to submit them, not just have that rejected out of hand.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hardin.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Commission, Art Trainer for the mine workers and the steel workers, interveners in this case. Congress didn't enact Section 110K on a blank slate. They explained to us in the legislative record why that unique statutory provision was included in the Act. It's because there had been a history of abuse where mine operators and representatives of the Secretary had, in fact, abused the settlement process to inappropriately lower penalties, thereby undermining their deterrent effect. Now, there's no evidence in the record here, and I have no reason to believe that that's what's going on in this case. In fact, I think it's pretty clear to everybody this is a test case, so that the secretary can push for a standard where the judges are not really fulfilling their responsibilities under Section 110K and are deferring to their negotiated settlement.
You think the Secretary wants us to rule against the Secretary?
No. Excuse me. No.
So they can take it up to the Circuit Court and get this all resolved?
Oh, I think they anticipate that will happen. I think it's clear from the discussions that were had by the commissioners after the first open meeting that the commission is pretty uniform. The commissioners uniformly agree that Section 110K means something, that it gives the commission and the judges a role, a meaningful role in the approval of settlements, and that that role is designed to prevent the recurrence of the abuses that prompted Congress to enact Section 110K in the first place.
Shouldn't the settlement be approved, though, if it is sufficient to satisfy that standard?
Yes.
That it's not an abusive collusion, a sweetheart deal, something like that.
Yes, but the judges do need, in order to be sure that that's not happening, some facts on which to analyze the appropriateness of the settlement. Because if we accept what counsel for the Secretary and American Coal want in terms of a standard and the way the judges carry out that function, they want the judges and the commission to defer to their experience and to presume that they entered into an arm's-length negotiation of the penalty reduction in good faith. And that's not consistent with the heightened standard or the higher standard that Section 110K requires. You know, when I hear about the way judges actually are carrying out their responsibilities under Section 110K and asking for a little bit of additional information here and there in order to approve settlements, I'm encouraged that Section 110K is working exactly the way Congress intended it to. And I hope that that continues. And that's why we need to keep the standard in Black Beauty, which does require the Secretary to provide some facts on which the judge can assess, do a meaningful assessment of whether the proposed penalty reduction is appropriate.
What's the standard there, though? Don't you have, if you have 12 judges, don't you have 12 standards for what's sufficient? What's my view of deterrence versus Judge Smith's view of deterrence?
I don't disagree with the notion that the judges have wide discretion when determining what is appropriate. Now, the Black Beauty directs says that it's not an abuse of discretion to require facts under Section 110I, and I think that's an appropriate part of the standard. I think when you look at bringing deterrence in there as another factor, it is a fairly wide standard, but I don't think there's anything legally infirm about giving the judges that discretion. I think when you hear the way the process has been working, the way we've heard from counsel today, the way it works, I think you see that that giving the judges wide discretion has worked, and the statistics bear out that it's worked. Well, you do have most cases that are proposed for settlement being approved.
Well, how much should we use the statistics? If the statistics seem to indicate that it works in the vast majority of cases, you know, you got that 99%, and then you have 90% of the remaining 1% that seem to involve one judge. Is that, I mean, are we talking about something that just involves a single judge and a single judge, and are we required to extend discretion to accommodate the preferences of a single judge or maybe two judges, if that's the case?
No, I think if a judge, first let me tell you that I don't have any particular knowledge about the practices of any one particular judge, so I can't answer your question there, but I think we heard that the concerns here are raised with respect to a number of judges, although there are no real facts in the record as to what is going on there. And, of course, if there were an abuse of discretion in any given case, if one judge did cross the line, I believe, as Commissioner Cohen said, that that would be a case to bring to the commission. And then the standard that was first articulated in Black Beauty could be further fleshed out. There's nothing wrong with an administrative agency, especially under the split enforcement model, adjudicating these issues and addressing these issues on a case-by-case basis. In fact, that's the virtue, that's the benefit of case-by-case adjudication, is that the standard can be more narrowly tailored as cases come up and present these problems. I think it's appropriate here that we don't have some specific across-the-board rule that governs in every particular case, because allowing the judges the flexibility allows them to respond to the particular circumstances that are presented by every case.
I agree with you. But in every case that is decided or settled becomes a data point of some type, correct?
It seems like it, yes.
So at the end of the day, what you have is you have a field of data that can be analyzed and characterized in a certain way.
Yes.
Even though these are being resolved on a case-by-case basis, and you can look for patterns, et cetera. Isn't this kind of a concern? I mean, just looking at what Mr. Waldman was talking about, not just from the Secretary talking about the facts of a particular case and the procedural considerations that the Secretary takes into mind in a particular case, but the more the Secretary is forced to disclose in the settlement process, doesn't that provide a data field for operators to use, and might that be maybe not such a great thing for the public interest?
I recognize from the perspective of a litigator the reluctance to divulge to opposing counsel or to the judge your view as to the weaknesses of your case. But I think we have to keep in mind here, first of all, there's no evidence that that has been a problem given the overwhelming number of settlements that are approved. But I think you also need to keep in mind that at the time the Secretary is asked to provide these facts, the settlement has already been reached, and it's being put forward for approval. And we've got an approval process that 99.9% of the time works. So as my colleague from the mine workers said in her oral argument when this case was first before the commission, what we've got here is a solution being proposed in search of a problem, solution in search of a problem. So if there is a problem that comes up in a future case, I think the Secretary should bring it forward. But I don't think there's a problem here with the way Judge Moran has used his discretion to deny this settlement, where there's a refusal to provide any substantive facts, and that refusal is positional in order to push a test case.
Well, there's not a refusal on the part of the operator, as counsel pointed out. Would you agree that it was an error?
Excuse me, I misspoke on that. There was a refusal on the part of the Secretary, because I understand from the record that the operator was willing to provide some facts.
Right, and the operator contends that that is a basis of grounds for error underlying the judge's opinion. Do you have a view on that?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's error that would justify overturning the decision, because when the judge asked the Secretary for facts, the Secretary refused, and I believe it's the Secretary that has the burden to justify the settlement.
Would it be error justifying remanding the case to allow those facts to come forward?
I think a remand of the case to allow the facts to come forward would be an appropriate outcome here, but I believe the Secretary should provide the facts, and that's what the judge required.
Well, you wouldn't object if the operator gave the facts to the Secretary and the Secretary gave them to the judge.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't.
While I've got you for a second, do you disagree that there's some value beyond monetary value to the operator accepting gravity and negligence for all the citations when it might have disputed and even won some of those had they gone to hearing? Is there value to accepting the citations as written?
Yes, there is value to accepting the citations as written for the purpose of future enforcement. However, in this particular case, I think that value is overstated. I believe the mine in question...
how do you quantify that value?
Well, no, I'll just say that I believe the mine in question here has ceased production. And so in this case, that value is minimal.
It might not be blather.
Right. That's correct. No,
it
I think
it might be a little bit more than blather.
So I can acknowledge that there is value in accepting the negligence and gravity as written for future enforcement purposes when there is an ongoing operation, and future enforcement can be enhanced based on the record of the citations as admitted. In this case, you might not have that. But there's also a deterrent purpose that's served by the penalty amounts. And
there's no reason to allow for an undermining of that deterrent by, you know, using a standard that doesn't police the settlement and the compromise of those penalties
but in order to keep that. What if the secretary, I'm sure it didn't happen this way. Suppose the secretary said, well, we think when we look at gravity and negligence as that might affect the penalty at the end of the hearing, we'd probably get, in our best estimate, a 20% reduction in the penalty. Mm-hmm. But here we'll also get them to agree to everything, so that's worth another 10% reduction in the penalty. How do we factor those things? I mean, can the value of the non-monetary value of accepting everything be weighed in with respect to the amount of the penalty?
The way you phrased the last question made it a lot easier for me to answer, and I would say yes, absolutely, it can. And I think there should be an explanation from the secretary as to what they're proposing in terms of and here there was some, you know, they said, look, we're accepting the gravity and negligence, or the operator is accepting the gravity and negligence, and that serves a deterrent purpose. I agree 100%.
But you wouldn't suggest that they have to tell us, well, we're weighing the monetary. We reduced it. We think it's a 15% penalty reduction based upon the merits of the charges, and we're giving them another 15% reduction because they're accepting the...
No, I don't think they would have to particularly quantify it. I don't think that's the way the judges have been doing it, at least not to my knowledge.
Right.
My knowledge is a little bit more limited to the record here in this case because... you know, we're regularly participating as interveners, but I'm not often involved in these settlement discussions myself. That's why it was very illuminating to hear counsel describe the process, and it was frankly heartening to me that the process is working. But it doesn't seem to me like any particular enforcement goals would be served by requiring the secretary to specifically describe the exact percentage value that they would attribute to having those elements accepted.
As far as that is a valid goal, though, an enforcement objective, isn't that within the purview of the secretary's prosecutorial discretion? I mean, the secretary has asserted virtually unreviewable discretion to make value judgments about prosecutions. Isn't there some aspect of this type of case that comes into play where the secretary is talking about enforcement priorities, dedication of resources, risk versus outcome? Don't we have to take that into account and respect that as a commission?
I think that the judge should take that into account, should hear those facts. But I think that the judge also needs, and the commission also needs, to make sure that they're fulfilling their statutory obligation under 110K to get enough information to be sure that the penalties aren't being compromised in a way that undermines their deterrent purpose. So the judge who's heard and approved numerous settlement decisions would know, I think, have a general feel as to what would be appropriate and what would not. But going specifically to your point about the allocation of resources, I think Congress said that the commission and the judges should be careful, and even the secretary should be careful, not to settle cases to conserve litigation resources. And I believe the secretary has the funding they need to litigate every case that they bring forward, assuming that the pattern of settlement that we've actually seen over the last, you know, even the last few years since the Black Beauty decision was issued, continues the way it has. I don't think that, and we don't see anything in the record suggesting that there is a resource problem here. In fact, it's my concern, again, there's nothing in the record about this, but we've gone a little bit beyond the record. It's my concern here that the solicitor's office is seeking to conserve resources in the area of mine safety enforcement to dedicate those resources to some other priorities. And I don't think that's appropriate or consistent.
Well, we are way beyond the record there.
Okay. Well, that's a concern I have, and it's speculative, I will admit. The problem we have here in this particular case is that the secretary's proposed settlement seeks approval of a compromise reached with the operator behind closed doors. And I think Section 110K is primarily about transparency.
And the process we have in place now assures transparency. It assures that miners' representatives, and the general public can look at the way that settlements are being compromised. They don't get a full look at all the considerations that went into the settlement, but there's by requiring the secretary to provide some basic justification based on substantive facts, it creates a record so that interested parties like Congress, like the mine workers, like the steel workers, can observe the process and make sure that we haven't reverted to the state of affairs that existed prior to enactment of the current legislation in Section 110K. And I think that's tremendously important, even if it is slightly more burdensome administratively for the secretary. You know, the secretary at one point in their brief refers to the need to come up with this substantive factual information in support of the reduction of the penalties as busy work. And I couldn't disagree more. That's work that enables there to be a record of what's happening in this process, which enables the transparency that Congress intended. It is perhaps more than what's required of attorneys who are litigating in some of the other contexts we've discussed here today. And that's what Congress intended. That is the system working. With respect to the particular facts that were raised or that were proposed here, I think everyone, I believe, is in agreement that these facts are more procedural than substantive. And I was listening to the recording of the open meeting that took place after the initial argument in this case. And Chairman Alton, I believe, I don't want to put words in your mouth, and I was listening as carefully as I could, but I hope
well,
I got
I
it right.
I blur my words all the time. Go ahead.
I hope I got it right when I heard you say that how the secretary enters into these settlements really isn't any of our business. It's more about whether the settlement is appropriate. And I think I agree there. I mean, I think there would be one carve-out that neither one of us had in mind.
You agreed with my statement?
Yes.
I'm writing that down.
I don't think I think there are some exceptions there where, of course, if there was actual corruption or collusion, we would want to know some facts about how the settlement was entered into. But I don't think, given the way things have operated since Congress enacted Section 110K, I don't think we've run across that problem. I think we're less likely to ever run across that problem because we have Section 110K.
But the issue I have is we're using the word facts, and it may have two meanings here. One is facts of sort of what happened on the ground, and another fact might be the thought of, though not strictly speaking, a fact that the secretary has determined that if it goes to hearing, the penalty may be reduced 50%.
Right.
That's not exactly a fact, but it is something that's relevant to the...
It's an opinion. Process. It's an opinion.
But it's the opinion of the prosecutor.
Yes, it is. But...
And I guess what they're also saying is not only... they didn't say this, but I think it's part of losing 50% of the penalty that some of the negligence and gravity determinations or the S&S determinations might get changed, and we like having those to be the same. So aren't those kinds of facts in the sense of facts justifying the settlement, are thought facts, if you will, well, justifying the settlement?
They are facts that should be provided and received by the judge, but I don't believe they're sufficient facts without some more information of the type that the judge was requesting.
But they did supply those facts.
Yes, and I think it's appropriate to provide those facts. I'm not up here saying that those facts shouldn't be provided, but they may not be sufficient. And the judge determined here that they aren't sufficient. I don't believe he abused his discretion in making that determination. You know, there are some cases, I believe, there's at least one case, the Arakoma Coal case, where it appears there were not specific facts provided for each particular citation that go to the 110I penalty criteria. But what did you have there? You had facts about other mechanisms that provided for substantial deterrence and provided a benefit to enforcement that the judges and the commission did consider, and they were able then to approve that settlement. It was a very unique situation.
That raises a question I did want to ask the union, though. Do you think where there's 32 citations, each citation has to be settled for a specific amount separately, or that across-the-board settlement of 30% for all of them is acceptable?
No, see, that's the type of hard and fast rule that I think the flexible standard the commission has articulated clearly doesn't require. I think that would constrain the judge's ability and the commission's ability to deal with unique situations like we saw in the Aracoma coal case, where I forget how many citations were at issue there. It was certainly a lot more than 50. And the commission was dealing with a backlog, and the flexibility inherent in the standard there allowed the commission to say, all right, well, look, we've got criminal penalties that are being assessed, and the judge, I believe, held on to their decision until they saw that there was a guilty plea entered.
But let's get to a more garden variety multi. Say there's 32 citations.
Yes.
Are you okay with settling 32 across the board rather than settling each of the 32 citations for a specific amount?
Yes, I believe the commission's articulated, certainly in the last American coal case and perhaps even in Black Beauty, if I recall correctly, that there's nothing per se improper about across the board penalty reductions. But I do believe that the judge was correct here in saying that heightens his need for some additional facts about the basis for entering into that kind of a settlement. I think it's appropriate when you see an across-the-board reduction to ask for some additional information about why that settlement was entered into, what justifies that settlement, what are the deterrent effects. I believe that when there's an across-the-board settlement, I think the judge below used the term red flag. Maybe that term's a little bit loaded, but it should heighten the judge's interest in the basis and the justification for the settlement. But those kinds of settlements should not be prohibited.
Let me ask you something to follow up on that. Let's say, using this case for an example, that the Secretary and American Coal presented a settlement which said, here are 14 cases where there may be a problem with negligence or gravity, and describe why there might be, as they usually do in settlement. And then says there's another case out there which we concern might be thrown out entirely. And then say, the other cases we think are pretty sound, but if you factor in the whole thing, we would like to settle it for 30% across the board. Would that be an acceptable settlement proposal?
I think so. I think the judge is going to have more experience than I do in assessing whether that particular percentage amount is appropriate, but I think that it's possible that that could be appropriate. You would, of course, want more information, as the judge requested here, about the relative merits of the 14 citations that are being compromised.
Yeah, no, I'm assuming that they're going to give that.
Yeah, and I think the judge should take into account the number of cases or the number of citations where the secretary believes they could move forward and get a final decision in their favor. That should be part of the factual record they use in assessing whether the particular percentage amount is appropriate. I can't tell you whether 14 out of 32, whether that means whether 30% is appropriate there. I think
I'm not asking you to determine whether anything is
set the math aside.
Yeah, structurally. You set forth, here are cases 1, 2, 3, 4, and you itemize why they're problematic. But then, having done that, you say, we're going to average it all out to 30%.
I don't see a problem with that. As long as you're taking into account the fact that, it would be 16 of the cases we know should be assessed at the full penalty amount as proposed, then you look at the reduction, you look at the discount that should be given for some of the other cases. I don't know precisely how you quantify it, but I think that structure is perfectly okay.
Okay.
There's one point that was raised in the Secretary's reply brief. It goes a little bit beyond what we've discussed here today, but I have a little bit more time, so I'll address it. The Secretary claims that if it were required to, if he were required to disclose certain substantive facts in order to justify the settlement, that that would be an infringement on the deliberative process privilege. In this particular case, I don't believe that argument is appropriately made because it wasn't raised below to the ALJ. It wasn't raised in the opening brief. And I just want that on the record. But let's get into the idea of this deliberative process privilege. I think it's probably the more interesting conversation. The deliberative process privilege is designed to encourage government agencies to have a free debate of ideas prior to entering into a policy decision. There's in the case law analyzing the deliberative process privilege, first of all, I'll say I did not find a case where the privilege was asserted to preclude against against a request from the adjudicating body to produce the facts necessary to meet the burden. The deliberative process is usually invoked in either FOIA requests or discovery requests from one party to another. But in all of those cases in that context, you see a distinction between opinion and fact. And the courts are always clear to say the underlying facts that were being deliberated are not covered by the privilege. The parties need access to the facts. It's the opinions of the agency that are protected, and for good reason. What's interesting here is that in the Secretary's offer to the judge, as we've seen and discussed, you really have nothing but their opinion. You have nothing but the Secretary saying, I've looked at the record, and it's my opinion that, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's getting into the stuff that the deliberative process privilege is intended to protect and to allow the Secretary to keep that close to his vest. And then the Secretary is not disclosing the facts, which is what the facts are what the courts have said are not protected by the deliberative process privilege. I bring that up because not only to address this point of the deliberative process privilege, but I think that analysis is sort of illuminating as to what types of facts are useful in the judges exercising their discretion over whether a settlement should be approved and what facts are not necessarily useful or necessary. And with that, I'll rest.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. I think we need a few seconds to reset the lights. Christoph, are we okay back there for the lights? Where's Imogene? Oh, there she is. Okay.
She's over there.
Wave at me, Imogene, when you're ready.
Okay.
Oh, ready? Okay, Mr. Waldman.
Let me assure you, Commissioner Altman, the Secretary does not wish to lose this case.
Well, I'm glad you said that because I actually have a question in my mind whether this isn't an effort by the Secretary to frame the perfect test case to take to the Circuit Court. Because what concerns me is if you win this case, big if, but if you win this case before us, in no way I can assure you would be, well, I can't assure you of anything, I'm one person, but I would assure you, I think, that we no way would say anything that would say our judges can't ask questions about settlements. In other words, if you're looking for a case that allows you to say, Circuit Court, if you're looking for a case that says, judge's clerk called and says, we'd like some more facts, and the lawyer says, no, I don't have to tell you, get lost. And that's the law. You won't get that kind of opinion out of it. I don't think you get opinion out of any court, but you certainly won't get that from us. And I'm a little concerned by this test case notion that's what you're hoping to get. That I don't quite understand the balance between surely you're not saying that when a settlement comes in, the judge's office can't ask for more support for the settlement. Or is that what you're saying?
What we're saying is that the administrative law judge on remand in this case defined the term fact in Commission Rule 31 too narrowly. And
well, I understand that, but in terms of when we talk, you've talked about sort of a systemic problem that you're being insensitive. We're talking about a systemic problem of the Secretary's counsel's being bogged down with having to get all these. I mean, you expressed a concern that judges are calling, the clerks are calling. You don't assert that the clerks can't call and ask for more facts, or do you?
No, I don't assert that, and I would point out that that was simply a response to Commissioner Cohen's question about a 99.83 approval rate, and I was just trying to show that
let me explain
that
if I,
there was a little bit more than just statistics.
I won't count this against your rebuttal time, which
has expired already.
Jane, is 2 minutes past? Those are our fast 2 minutes. Anyway,
time flies when you're having fun.
Right. I think the D.C. Circuit went way over the other day, too, so we can. What do you see as the limits, if there's any, on the judges or their clerks' right to ask questions? And I'll go further and say why I think of this as something of the agencies have very well-defined areas of law that they cover, the prosecutorial function and the adjudicative function. And we ought to try and work respectfully to each other to carry out those functions. I think everybody agrees with that. I have to bring up a specific instance of a few months ago where Judge Moran had before him a settlement of two citations, both in assessed penalties an equal amount in both, and he denied it. The Secretary didn't come forward with more facts. What the Secretary did was vacate one of the citations and take the full amount of the other citation. Now, I have to tell you, I was offended by that tactic because that was disrespectful of Judge Moran and his commission, as it seemed to me. The proper thing to do would have been to come back with some facts. That makes me a little suspicious that you just don't want to do the work of settling these cases to the satisfaction of our judges. Can you assure me that's not true?
Yes, I can assure you that's not true. I'm not familiar with the particular case.
You can see how that's a little insulting.
I suppose I could.
I mean, and that ripples. I didn't talk to anybody about it, but I think every judge must have said, what? I mean, those kinds of things actually encourage the schoolyard fight that we ought to be putting aside.
Exactly.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to read to you, and I've cited this in my brief. It's the definition of a fact from Black's Law Dictionary. I didn't quote the entire definition in my brief, but I would like to read it right now, if you'll indulge me. Something that actually exists, an aspect of reality. Facts include not just tangible things, actual occurrences and relationships, but also states of mind, such as intentions and the holding of opinions. I think the problem in this case comes down to the definition of a fact. The ALJ here is the Commission's Rule 31 is based on the term fact, and that's a very broad term. This definition goes on for 6 pages, by the way, with 55 subcategories of facts, including adjudicative facts, evidentiary facts, facts and evidence, so on and so forth. So I think the use of the term fact in Rule 31 is a little bit problematic in that, you know, 55 different people can interpret it 55 different ways. And I think the way the ALJ interpreted it here was incorrect. In response to Commissioner Cohen's question, why aren't we seeing that kind of case? Commissioner Cohen, you are. Very recently, ALJ Moran certified for interlocutory review a case called Solar Sources, Lake Number 2017-52, in which...
Could you give it that site again?
Lake 2017-52, and the operator is Solar Sources. And that's a case where ALJ Moran demanded that the secretary provide the inspector's notes in support of the proposed settlement. The secretary said no, and we asked that he certify for interlocutory review. He did in late April. I don't know if the commission is aware of that, because the ALJ's decision is not posted on the commission's website, so I'm a little bit concerned that perhaps it fell through the cracks. But in any event, in answer to your question, why aren't we seeing that kind of case, you are and you will. Okay. And that's one. I'd rest at this point. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wolfman. Mr. Harden?
I've got 3 points I'd like to make quickly on rebuttal, hopefully. First, picking up where Mr. Waldman left off, you know, there's nothing in the Mine Act or the legislative history that says that facts, let alone substantive facts about the 110i criteria, have to be disclosed during the settlement approval process. What the legislative history says is that the process has to be disclosed. And so the mine operator submits that, again, at least with respect to the settlement approval process, frankly, the most important facts are the ones about the process, because those are the ones that show there's no collusion. The substantive facts, that's what's hotly disputed in settlement negotiations. The material facts of gravity and negligence, I can promise you, are rarely agreed upon in the many settlement agreements that I've done. That's what we're fighting over. So to then force the parties to come forward and say, here's what the substantive facts are and why we reach a settlement, I mean, it's going to force one or both of the parties to basically fall on its sword, which neither of the parties are really going to be willing to do. So that's my first point. The second point is...
Doesn't that happen 99% of the time?
You know, that 99% of the time, again, how many of those initially were rejected? What is the percentage of settlements that are submitted that are initially rejected and where more information is requested? That's the statistic that I'd like to know. Because you're talking about the final amount that are settled. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest to you that the mine operators are responsible for making a lot of those settlements get approved when the judges do come back for more information. And so I think it's a lower percent. I don't know what it is. Is it 95%? Is it 96%? I don't think it's 99.83%. I guarantee you that there is a substantial percentage where judges do ask for more additional substantive facts before a settlement is approved. And again, that kind of goes to rarely do you see a docket.
But if settlement gets approved, what's the problem?
Well, again, what are the boundaries within which the parties have to operate? Okay? That's the ultimate question.
Let me ask you, what's the harm? I mean, so what? You're getting your settlements.
Well, if we're getting
I mean, you haven't spent too much time on them? Or is that the problem? Or?
No. And again, to be clear, I think the judge crossed the line on remand in this case. I'm not here to weigh in on the prior appeal. I do believe, and the mine operator believes, the judge crossed the line on remand in this case. I see that my time's over. Can I continue answering?
Go ahead, finish your answer.
So, there's 3 things, and we've raised them in our brief. And one, the judge rejected the process facts out of hand. The judge should have at least considered those neutrally. That's number one. And I think that the commission should require your judges, if process-related facts are submitted as part of a settlement motion, the judges should at least neutrally analyze them. I think that should be required. I think it is required by your prior precedent. Number two, the judge rejected the settlement because he wanted an explanation on substantive facts on gravity and negligence for each violation to show that a 30% reduction was warranted for each violation. I believe that's contrary to commission precedent. There is precedent that shows that uniform penalty reductions for a global settlement like this one, this is a global settlement, there are 32 different fact patterns at issue in this docket, that he should have at least considered that and should not have required a violation-specific facts to justify 30% for each one. And I think that's, again, prior commission precedent. And third, the judge required the secretary to show legitimate questions of fact with respect to the substantive facts on gravity and negligence. And I don't know of any case, I don't know of any statute, I don't know of any legislative history or any rule. The union didn't oppose this. Our position on this, I don't think there's any basis to require that, and frankly, I think that would chill settlement negotiations, and that would greatly lower, I think, the percentage of settlements you see if parties are required to come in and say, this is a legitimate question of fact. So I think that one's a solid issue. My third and final point.
The judge sometimes overstates things and uses language that might be described as colorful. If we were to clarify some of these concerns that you have, I mean, for example, The use of the word legitimate facts by the judge was in the context of him addressing your offering to supply facts, and I'm not sure what legitimate meant there. And the point of the judge rejecting all process facts, I'm not sure but that if some substantive facts had been offered him, he would have rejected something like, well, we think it would have been 50% loss. If we address those things, doesn't that kind of solve your concerns?
I think if you address the three points that we raised in our brief, yes, I think that would help resolve some of our concerns. And frankly, if you address those three issues, which I think all weigh in favor of I think you should rule in the mine operator's favor on all three of those points, given prior commission precedent. Then I think, which brings my third point, that there should not be a remand. The commission should approve this settlement because enough facts have been given for this particular case. In particular, the most critical fact, as noted during the open meeting and the previous appeal, is that all of the paper stayed the same. And that's a significant concession on the part of the mine operator.
Even granted, when the mine's closed?
Well, it's not the mine operator's fault that this case has taken 8 years to get to this point. If this had come to fruition 3 or 4 years ago, the mine would have still been open, and we could have dealt with this in that case. I agree. The mine is closed, and so what's the point now? But the point is, when this settlement was reached years ago, this had meaning. And the meaning was that it would have maximized the impact on the violation history of the mine operator. And that's a significant fact that merited the 30% reduction in this case, alone, by itself, I believe, given the negotiating history between the parties. And so with that, I would ask that the commission grant our petition on all three points and reverse the judge, approve the settlement with no remand. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Faber. Anything further, counsel? I will note that commission expires on August 30. This is apt to be the last oral argument I hear, so I want to thank Mr. Waldman, Mr. Hardin, the union's lawyers for the excellent arguments they've made over the years, which has been much appreciated. Thank you very much.
And I concur.
Commissioner McCone concurs.
My last oral argument, too.
We finally agreed on something. You're all good lawyers. With that, we'll go off the record.